Good morning from the Financial Times. Today is Monday, May 6th, and this is your FT News Briefing. Chinese President Xi Jinping is looking to do some damage control in Europe, and everyone's wondering what to do with Russia's frozen assets. Plus, U.S. college students want their universities to divest from Israel. But it's not that easy. I'm Kasia Bursalian, and here's the news you need to start your day. Xi Jinping is in Europe this week, and his main mission is to avert a trade war. Today, he'll meet with French President Emmanuel Macron, and they'll hold some pretty tough talks over the mounting number of EU investigations into Chinese companies. Now, Europe is China's second largest regional trading partner, so Xi has to play a pretty important balancing act here. Experts say he'll be on a charm offensive, but also he'll be willing to play hardball. That includes threatening restrictions on exports. Still, China does have a few good friends in Europe. Xi will visit Serbia and Hungary next, and both have benefited from a surge in Chinese investment. After Russia launched its full-scale invasion of Ukraine, Western allies went to work on sanctions. They froze hundreds of billions of euros in Russian assets. And ever since, people have been debating whether to give those assets to Ukraine. The debate got a lot more urgent in recent weeks, and here to talk to us about it is the FT's Paola Tama. Hey, Paola.
Hi, Kasia.
Okay, so first things first, when we're talking about Russian assets, what are they exactly and where are they?
So essentially, in 2022, one of the first measures that G7 and their allies took against Russia for its invasion of Ukraine was to freeze Russian central bank foreign reserves that they held, the majority of which, the great majority, sits where I'm sitting, so Belgium, about 190 billion, in the one central securities depository, which is called Euroclear. So they've been just stuck there. And as time goes on, some of these securities come to maturity and they turn into cash. And Euroclear is reinvesting them and making a profit on them.
Got it. So explain the situation a little bit more. For those who want to redistribute these funds to Ukraine, what's their plan?
The basic idea is confiscation. So just seizing these assets and giving them to Ukraine. That's something that Ukraine argues. And they say that they have a right to this money because of Russia's illegal war of aggression. And that's something that's backed by the U.S. administration. So they have been arguing for months now that the West should just take this money and give it to Ukraine. The rest of the G7, however, is split.
Yeah, tell me a little bit more about that. For those who aren't in favor of confiscating these assets directly, what are they worried about?
The Europeans are the people who are most prominently against this. This is partly because the majority of these assets, as we said, sit in Europe, and they fear that any consequences will be felt mostly here. They're afraid of a number of things. Number one, I think, is doing something like that could create a legal precedent that would upset something called state immunity. So that's the recognition that every state is sovereign. And they fear that setting this precedent by taking away Russia's reserves without its consent could lead to all sorts of claims to everybody's property held abroad. Particularly, Germany has concerns when it comes to reparations that countries could advance to it regarding World War II. But also other countries fear, you know, if they were former colonial powers, any number of countries could lay any claim at their feet saying, well, actually, this is owed to us now. And then there's other concerns. One is from central bankers. They really hate the idea of confiscation and doing anything with these assets at all because they fear it would threaten monetary security. Foreign reserves is something that countries use to maintain the value of their currency. And if suddenly you take it over and just decide that it's no longer the state's property, it could really deal a blow to the monetary system.
Oh. Yeah, and both of those sound pretty concerning. I mean, on the one hand, you have a country that could potentially lose its financial assets because of a conflict, even one that happened a while ago. And the same goes with the market instability. So then what might be the next steps when it comes to Russia's frozen assets?
So I think that even though the US is still pushing for the idea of confiscation, there is not really a hope that the G7 will come to an agreement on this at all. So what they've done is reorient themselves towards the profits that these assets have been generating. So as I said before, Euroclear has been sitting on a majority of these assets, and today they have generated around $5 billion. The Americans would like to essentially bring forward the future value of these assets and say, well, every year, these assets generate about $3 billion per year. Why don't we just say, well, here is a loan or a bond for Ukraine for the value of 10, 20, 30 years worth of these profits that could generate, you know, anywhere between $50 to $100 billion, and just basically front load the value of these profits to Ukraine. The Europeans, however, say, well, we have our own plan for these profits. Essentially, it's going to agree in the coming weeks on taking away these profits every year, every half a year from Euroclear, and then using it to buy weapons for Ukraine. These is supposed to come to about $3 billion per year. And it's the real profits themselves, not a loan, not debt issued on the back of their future.
Paola Tama is an EU correspondent for the FT. Thanks, Paola.
Thank you.
Berkshire Hathaway is sitting on its biggest pile of cash ever, $189 billion in the first quarter of 2024. That's an all-time high and a sign that Warren Buffett's massive business is still dumping a lot of stocks, including Apple. It also highlights the difficulty that he and his team have had in finding any worthwhile investments. The cash figure was made public on Saturday during Berkshire's annual meeting in Omaha, Nebraska. Just a fun fact, it's known as the Woodstock of capitalism. The big piece of news to come out of that party concerned Buffett's plans for his succession. He said that Greg Abel would one day make the lion's share of Berkshire's investment decisions. That gives him oversight of hundreds of billions of dollars. So no pressure there, Greg. Students have been camping out on college campuses in the U.S. to protest the war in Gaza. And one of the things that they're demanding is for their universities to divest from Israel. But it's not that simple. Here to explain why is the FT's Brooke Masters. Hi, Brooke.
Hi.
So what's going on here in terms of students wanting universities to pull their money from companies that do business in Israel?
Basically, there are students protesting on any number of campuses saying that they don't want their universities profiteering from murder. That's their argument. And there are obviously, it's a very complicated situation, but the history of divestment is a long and rich one in the U.S. The most famous one is in the 80s. Students did very similar things. They built shanty towns and protested and invaded administration buildings, demanding divestment from apartheid-era South Africa. And back then, lots of universities did. But these days, things are a lot more complicated. In the 80s, most universities invested by buying shares in direct companies. So they could pick and choose what they wanted. And if they didn't want to invest in South Africa, they could sell those companies.
Yeah. How does that compare with the current situation?
Now, because of the way the investment world has changed, a lot of university endowments are invested in what are known as index tracking funds. You know, this is like an S&P 500 fund that you might have in your retirement plan. Or they are also invested in what are known as alternatives, which are private equity and private credit funds, where you buy the whole package and you sort of get what you get and don't get upset. It's a lot harder for a university endowment to immediately figure out what they have. And what that means is that it's very hard to determine your exposure and decide even if you wanted to get out.
So it sounds like these universities have a much less clear understanding of what they're invested in these days. What explains that switch from the 1980s?
It's a search for higher returns, particularly in an era of cheap money. So up until 2022, private investments were offering much higher returns, particularly than standard bonds. And then in terms of the stocks, the reason they buy funds instead of buying individual stocks is they don't think that they can afford to buy managers who are good at picking stocks. So it's just cheaper to go hire, you know, say Fidelity to pick stocks for you. Or if you believe in passive investing where you buy the whole market, obviously you buy that in a fund.
Got it. So they're chasing higher returns through private investment and through funds. So then how are universities responding to all this pressure from students to divest?
Depends on the school. I mean, you know, both Brown and Northwestern have tried to de-escalate by saying, yes, we will try to get you more information and we will have a serious conversation about whether divesting from companies that do business in Israel is feasible, what it would cost, does it make sense, will it accomplish what we want? The other thing to remember is that with technology, there actually are answers to some of these questions. Most universities have not bothered to use them, but it is possible. There is a technology known as a separately managed account, where instead of like buying an S&P 500 fund, you buy your own version of it. And in fact, say, actually, I'm going to have the S&P 500 fund minus any stock that makes more than 1% of its income from Israel. This works for really rich people, and it works for really big investors because they can afford to buy one of everything or five of everything or whatever to make it all work.
So there are potential solutions then, at least to getting, you know, more clarity on these investments. But what does this mean going forward? Can universities potentially divest after the fact or maybe even predict where the next issue will come up?
I think the idea of trying to predict a hotspot and get out ahead of it is probably unrealistic because you never know, you know, what will upset students. There are horrible conflicts happening all over the world and we don't divest from them. So I don't think that universities will ever be able to avoid these kinds of conflicts because new issues arise all the time. But at least they won't be able to say, oh, well, we don't even know. We can't do anything. We can't tell you. And these are institutions that are supposed to teach people and supposed to have values. And so to claim that we have no control over this vast piles of money they control is problematic.
Brooke Masters is the FT's U.S. financial editor. Thanks, Brooke.
Thanks for having me.
You can read more on all of these stories at FT.com for free when you click the links in our show notes. This has been your daily FT News Briefing. Make sure you check back tomorrow for the latest business news.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
Join Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin for a new edition of the Capital Ideas Podcast. In unscripted conversations with investment professionals, you'll hear real stories about successes and lessons learned, informed by decades of investment experience. It's your look inside one of the world's largest asset managers. New episodes are available monthly. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Invest 30 minutes in an episode today. Published by American Funds Distributors, Inc.